This is Jess Goldson, and you are listening to CJRU 1280 AM in Toronto. This story is part of the Local Journalism Initiative, a project by the Community Radio Fund of Canada. This series is centered on the opioid crisis in Toronto, including harmful substance use. In this episode, we hear about the study on the effect of COVID-19 on intravenous drug users, including those who are in opioid agonist treatment. Opioid agonists are medications that prevent withdrawal and reduce cravings for opioid drugs. Zach Book, PhD candidate at the Dalla Lana School of Public Health at U of T and research associate, assessed the effect of COVID-19 on those who inject drugs. Book describes the two forms of opioid agonist treatment.
Opioid agonist treatment is the first-line therapy for individuals who have what's called opioid use disorder. It previously was referred to as either opioid dependence or opioid abuse, depending on the severity, but that language is no longer in the lexicon. So for individuals who have moderate to severe opioid use disorder in Canada, regardless of what province or territory you're in, the recommended first-line treatment for that is either methadone, which comes in the liquid formulation, or Suboxone, which comes in a sublingual or under-the-tongue tablet. And there's also newer formulations constantly coming into the market and available, obviously, as we continue to deal with this opioid epidemic.
Health Canada implemented a number of initial changes to opioid agonist treatment protocols in response to the State of Emergency Declaration on March 17,
2020. It was March 17, 2020 in Ontario that State of Emergency Declaration happened. Very shortly thereafter, as obviously all the provinces were doing it, Health Canada came in and introduced temporary federal exemptions to the Controlled Drugs and Safety Act, which basically facilitated access to a lot of different controlled substances, which opioid agonists, methadone and Suboxone actually fit under. And what this basically allowed was three things. The first was it allowed prescribers, clinicians, nurse practitioners, et cetera, to both renew and extend prescriptions remotely. The second, it allowed pharmacists at the sites that are actually dispensing it to extend and transfer prescriptions to help make sure that there's no gaps in care. And then the third was it actually allowed pharmacy employees to deliver these prescriptions, including opioid agonist treatment, to people who are self-isolating at home or other locations. That obviously the issue is people want to mitigate their risk at the same time. So in isolation, that was the first response. And then the second piece that was changed, which was more of a provincial than a federal level, was a couple of days later after that. So the 17th was the State of Emergency Declaration. The 19th of March was the federal exemptions were first enacted, and they're still in effect. And they're in effect, I think, till September of 2026 currently, and hopefully will stay. And then the second piece was the provincial side. They released three different organizations, which is affiliated with Women's College Hospital, the Ontario Medical Association, and CAMH, put out a document that was basically treatment guidance for both prescribers and pharmacists during the pandemic on how to improve access potentially to opioid agonist treatment, given the anticipated barriers imposed by all of the provincial restrictions. The first was basically to obviously prioritize virtual over in-person visits where possible. The second one was to reduce urine drug screening, which isn't often a component that people have to like clear routinely to stay on treatment and show that they're not concurrently using other opioids. And the third piece was to facilitate people getting take-home doses, which I was saying you have to go into the clinic and have observed doses. The take-home component is that some of your doses in a week or even longer period of time, you might actually be able to take them at your own discretion in a given day and you get them from the pharmacy all at once. And how they basically did that was by relaxing the criteria that existed prior to make it possibly more available and eligible to a larger group of people.
Book describes a cohort of people studied over 2 6-month periods, one before the emergency order and the second during COVID.
Normally what we would do if we wanted to evaluate how programs changed and how that impacted use of opioid agonist treatment, we would have some sort of period where the only thing that changed between the pre and the post was the delivery changes that I'll talk about. But obviously what we had was these program changes were in response to pandemic restrictions and physical distancing recommendations. So we have this overlap of two things that we expect to go in opposing directions. In isolation, the pandemic restrictions and physical distancing recommendations and all that guidance that was instituted, recommended federally and then instituted provincially and territorially, that would be expected to worsen treatment access. Because on the supply side or service side, you'd expect that community pharmacies that dispense opioid agonist treatment would potentially have service disruptions, maybe either reduced capacity or even temporary closures because they're dealing with an outbreak. And then on the individual side, there's this tension between, I might want to start treatment or continue to take opioid agonist treatment. However, the reality is that the main way it's dispensed is daily, where they have to go into the actual pharmacy and receive a dose that's then witnessed. That's the main way that this treatment is dispensed. And individuals might counteract that and say, well, if I have to constantly go in and have all these in-person or in-clinic encounters, I might then increase my risk of SARS-CoV-2 infection and getting COVID. So I might be dissuaded from going to the actual clinic and starting it.
Book outlines the discrepancy between the cohorts studied and the larger population of people who inject drugs.
Through our team at the Center on Drug Policy Evaluation, we actually have this prospective community recruited cohort. It's called the Ontario Integrated Supervised Injection Services, or OISIS is the short form acronym, Toronto cohort. And basically it's individuals who at baseline or at the time of recruitment are all 18 years of age or older. They're living in Toronto and they report in the past 6 months that they've injected drugs. The actual drug that they've injected doesn't matter. It's just that they have to have had recent injection drug use. Unique about this cohort of individuals is that, unlike a lot of other cohorts that involve people who inject drugs, we link the questionnaires that we give them. We obviously collect a lot of data on their demographics, what drugs they're injecting or not injecting, how frequently, what services they're using. We do all do the like self-reported through questionnaire, but we also ask these individuals if they're willing to, it's on another piece of optional consent to have their questionnaire or self-reported data linked at basically this provincial repository of routinely collected health administrative data at an institute called ICES. It only goes by that acronym now, but it used to be the Institute for Clinical Evaluative Sciences. And basically, it allows us to take all that rich self-reported data on things that otherwise wouldn't get captured and pair it with potentially more objective clinical data, including prescription drug claims. Because we have this unique cohort where we have obviously the self-reported data paired with this health administrative data, we effectively looked at five different outcomes. The first outcome we looked at was just how, in a given week, how many people in our cohort were enrolled on OAT or opioid agonist treatment. The second thing we looked at was opioid-related overdoses. So this measure, it's limited, but it looks at whether they've had a hospitalization or an ED visit in the past week for an opioid-related poisoning, our best proxy measure we can use right now. The third one we looked at was all-cause death, which obviously we're mostly focused on opioid deaths, but the idea that obviously that would be caught under that umbrella. And then the last two outcomes we looked at was just among the people who had the first outcome. So among the people who in a given week were enrolled in opioid agonist treatment, we looked at whether they received any take-home doses, so at least just one day's worth of take-home doses. And the second one was whether they in the same week underwent urine drug screening. The larger cohort we have isn't necessarily people who have potentially an opioid use disorder, but what we had to do in our study is we narrowed down slightly from 521 people that we have linked at ICS with administrative and cohort data. And we ended up looking at 359 people who, based on their initial baseline questionnaire responses, had a suspected opioid use disorder, just because they would be the people who potentially would be eligible for and obviously the most likely to benefit from opioid agonist treatment. In isolation, we had basically a 53-week or 1 week over a year period, 26 weeks before the emergency declaration happened. And then obviously within the same week, both of those other changes, the exemptions and the treatment guidance came out. So that week was excluded because a lot of stuff was happening. And then there was the 26 weeks post that we looked at after. So basically just 2 6-month periods pre and post.
Book indicates here the expected versus realized outcomes of the changes to service delivery during the pandemic on people who inject drugs.
What we would have expected in isolation just from the pandemic restrictions, obviously, is potentially worsening opioid agonist treatment enrollment over time, increases in overdose, which is what we're seeing at the Toronto level and provincial level in the larger population. We would have expected, obviously, unfortunately, an increase in incidence of death, all cause, but probably driven by opioid-related overdoses because of the adulteration of the drug supply. And then we wouldn't have probably expected much of a difference in take-home doses and urine drug screening, although we might have seen potentially a drop in take-home doses because people have to be retained on treatment for a while to even get them. And the idea is that because of service-related interruptions due to the pandemic, people would drop off treatment and people wouldn't start.
Book indicates here the expected versus realized outcomes of the changes to service delivery during the pandemic on people who inject drugs.
So what we saw, and it indicates evidence that the two other changes, both the exemptions and particularly the treatment guidance, might have had a beneficial impact on mitigating these pandemic barriers, was we actually saw a small increase in enrollment, nothing substantial, but that it was fairly static, which would probably be considered a win by most. We didn't see an increase in opioid-related overdoses, which is quite surprising because our actual cohort, while not maybe representative of the entire population of people who inject drugs in Toronto, is characterized by extreme structural vulnerabilities, and a lot of them have reported a recent overdose at baseline and frequent injection drug use. And then we didn't actually see, thankfully, a very small number of people to the point where I can't even report the number based on our policies of people died. So what we would have expected at least is those three things to all get much worse. And that didn't happen, thankfully, at least within obviously our study population. And then beneficially among those in a given week who are on opioid agonist treatment, what we saw is that immediately after all three of these changes happened, but potentially attributable to the two positive changes, is that there was this huge immediate increase in the percentage of people who were on opioid agonist treatment getting a take-home dose in that same week. And then that increase was sustained over the whole 26-week period. So basically it jumped almost about 18% right off the bat, and it was still about 15% higher than what you would have expected had these changes never happened. And lastly, urine drug screening basically dropped the other way. It went down 20%, as you'd expect based on what the guidance was recommending, and it stayed pretty low, but over time it returned, similar to OAT enrollment, was back to almost pre-levels. Our study period was largely through wave one, and then the beginning of wave two of the pandemic. As things loosened, people didn't feel as bad about having people come in for more routine urine drug screening. However, the take-home dosing still held at a higher level than what we would have anticipated in the absence of these interventions.
After changing how it was administered as a result of the pandemic, opioid agonist treatment enrollment increased by 18% at the start of the pandemic, which was 50% higher than expected at that point in time. This is Jess Goldson, and you've been listening to CJRU 1280 AM in Toronto. This story is part of the Local Journalism Initiative, a project by the Community Radio Fund of Canada. This series focused on the imperative need for harm reduction services in Toronto. We've learned that harm reduction takes many forms and that abstinence is not the most effective way to support drug-using people. We learned the need for drug checking to verify the contents of the drugs and avoid toxicity. In this third and final episode, we learned about the impact of COVID-19 on intravenous drug-using people, including those in opioid agonist treatment. Going forward, it is imperative for the government to increase the accessibility of drug checking services well beyond the downtown core, as well as extend the take-home dose option for opioid agonist treatment beyond the pandemic. Thank you for listening.